Well, hey everybody, it is so great to see you, whether you're here in the room or joining us online. I know I say this every single time we're together, but it is truly an honor to have you along for the ride. And as you have already noticed, today we are still in a series called Virtual Israel. Randy reminds me regularly that this is the longest series in Keystone's history, and I'm like, why not keep the ball rolling? But hey, by the end of April, we're moving on, I promise, okay? But if you're joining us for the first time, and I know at least a few of you who are, you should know that this is content I've been working on in preparation for some upcoming trips to Israel that we plan to take over the next few years. And each week in this series, I introduce you to one of the sites that's included. Hello, Randy. Oh, we've got a sing. Hey, this is just like last week. It's pretty cool. By the way, Ryan crushed it last week. Give him a round of applause. Yeah, really good. And Randy is apparently a really good tech guy sometimes, but it's okay. Pay no attention to the guy standing next to me. All right. Anyway, each week in this series, I introduce you to one of the sites that's included on the itinerary for our trips, and then I present some of the material. I can't do it. I present some of the content that I plan to present at that location. And so anyway, with our time today, I want to show you a site that I'm almost certain you've never heard of before. It's called Tabgha, and it sits less than a mile from Capernaum. That's the town Jesus called home during the 3 years he spent with his disciples. Now, archaeologists tell us that in ancient times, Tabgha was the spot where 7 freshwater springs entered the Sea of Galilee. Tabgha actually means 7 springs. And so apparently whenever springs enter lakes, and I don't know this because I don't really fish, that's a great spot to go fishing. And just hold on to that. That becomes really important later in our talk. Anyway, what I want to do now is show you a 25-second video of what Tabgha looks like should you join me on a visit there today. So let's watch the screens. Now, Tabgha is, without question, one of my favorite spots in all the land of Israel, not only because of its stunning natural beauty, which you just saw on the video, but because it really is the perfect spot to consider a concept that stands right at the center of the mission and message of Jesus, the concept of grace. And here's why I say that. It was near Tabgha, almost 2,000 years ago, that Jesus made one of the most significant invitations of his life. Seriously, it was an invitation to someone who was emotionally reeling from a personal failure that had left them feeling unworthy of and disqualified from a relationship with him. Now, I've pointed to this invitation more times than I can count during the years I've served as a pastor because, well, as a pastor, I regularly meet with people who reach moments in their lives, moments in their spiritual journey where they really wonder if Jesus wants anything to do with them after what they have done. And when we get together, often over Starbucks, because that's where these conversations happen, right? They say things to me like, you know, deep down I feel like I've gone too far. I've done too much. My life is, has been, and likely will continue to be a hot mess. That's a technical theological term. You can look it up later, right? They say, like, I mean, I have to believe that my decisions have somehow disqualified me from a relationship with Jesus. If I were him, I would want nothing to do with me. I think if I ever walked through the doors of church again, they'll say, you know, I feel like the roof might collapse in on me. God might just take me out right then and there. And whenever I have these conversations, I always ask, you know, where did you get this idea that Jesus is sort of done with you after what you've done? And I've noticed something. When I ask people that question, the answer often has something to do with church. Because at some point, a well-intentioned pastor or elder or small group leader or Sunday school teacher or friend gave them a sense that, you know, because of their choices, they weren't really welcome in church anymore. And they concluded that if they really weren't welcomed in church, if church wanted nothing to do with them, then why would Jesus want anything to do with them? And to be honest, from a human perspective, that kind of makes sense, even though it's not true. And that fact, the fact that it's not true, is really good news. In fact, when the message went out in the ancient world, they called it gospel. It means good news. And so the gospel is why during these meetings, I always say the same thing. It's our big idea for today. And it goes like this. In Jesus' eyes, your failure, whatever it is not final. In fact, whatever is in your past, Jesus offers you a new beginning. And then I say something like this. I say, you know, I believe with all my heart that he wants a relationship with you even after what you did, even after what you didn't do, even after what you said, even after you were unfaithful, even after you let someone down, even after you took something that wasn't yours to take. Even after all that, Jesus wants you to follow him. And then I say, you know, and there's actually a bit more, because believe it or not, even though it doesn't feel like it, the fact that you feel so profoundly unworthy is helpful, because it means that you're ready for an authentic, transformational encounter with the grace of God. Now, at this point in the conversation, especially if there's some emotion that the person is carrying into the conversation, they'll look at me often with tears in their eyes and say, you know, that honestly, that sounds too good to be true. Where in the world did you get that idea? And I always respond the same way. I got the idea from Jesus. And then I point them to the invitation that Jesus made near Tabgha to someone who had functionally abandoned him during the most challenging day of his life. Someone who believed that they had gone too far, that they had done too much, that Jesus would want nothing to do with them. And I point them there because I'm convinced by watching how Jesus treats him, we can get a sense of how Jesus would treat us when we fail in all sorts of ways. Now before I show you the invitation Jesus made, let me give you a bit of context. As we enter the biblical story, God has just done something unbelievable yet undeniable. After a brutal death on a Roman cross, Jesus has appeared once again to his disciples very much alive. And you should know, this was not what any of them were expecting. They truly believed that when Jesus died, that was the end of his story, and it was the end of their stories as far as it was connected to him. Because when Jesus died, their hope about who Jesus was and what he was going to do died as well. Jesus had simply claimed way too much about himself. I mean, he had said that he was the Son of God. And they would think, well, how in the world can the Son of God die? Jesus had claimed to be the Messiah, and Messiahs weren't supposed to be crucified. And so when Jesus died, all of their assumptions, all of their hopes, and all of their dreams for their future with him died as well. But you see, then when Jesus appeared to his followers on that first Easter Sunday, everything changed. They had to rethink everything. And after getting over that initial shock, Jesus envisioned them and empowered them to tell the world what God had done through him. It was a new mission that was supposed to carry them for the rest of their lives. And honestly, they couldn't wait for their next chapter to begin. Well, if I'm honest with you, most of them couldn't wait for their next chapter to begin, because Jesus' disciple Peter was wondering if Jesus would ever trust him again, because Peter had failed Jesus in a pretty major way, and he wondered if his actions disqualified him from any sort of relationship, from any sort of future with Jesus. Peter, and many of you know the story, but Peter had denied Jesus at his darkest hour. And to make matters worse, a few hours before he did that, Peter had promised not to. Seriously, moments after the meal that we remember as the Last Supper, Peter had looked Jesus straight in the eye. Here's what he said. He said, Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death. Like, whatever happens to you, Jesus, I'm right by your side. I'm your wingman. I'm not going anywhere. And without hesitation, Jesus responded with a prophecy that would have shook Peter to his core. He looked back at Peter and he says, Peter, not only is that not true, but here's the specifics. He says, I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny three times that you even know me. And Peter would have been stunned, because at the Last Supper, Peter would have done anything for Jesus. I mean, think about what he had seen. Peter had watched Jesus heal the blind and the deaf. He'd even watched Jesus raise a man named Lazarus from the grave. He believed Jesus was going to change the world, and he was going to help him do it. I mean, Peter would have thought, what else in the world would I rather do with my life? So at this moment, the idea that he would deny Jesus once, let alone three times, was, honestly, it was unthinkable. It seemed impossible. But a few hours later, just like Jesus said, it happened. And as Peter was denying Jesus the third time, Luke gives us an interesting detail. He records that the Lord turned. So speaking of Jesus, Jesus turned and look at that, looked straight at Peter. Can you imagine what Peter felt in that moment? I think I can. Exposed, embarrassed, afraid, disappointed. I mean, we can't be sure, but whatever he felt, it wasn't good. And as best we can tell, the next time Peter saw Jesus, Jesus was hanging on a cross. And Peter would have been flooded with emotions, right? I mean, he would have been devastated for the loss of his rabbi, his teacher, his friend. But those feelings would have been commingled with something way more personal, because in a very real sense, Peter had betrayed Jesus. Well, 3 days later, against all odds, Peter found himself face to face with Jesus again. And Peter had seen Jesus' wounds, and he had heard Jesus' words pointing to hope and power and a new beginning. But Peter had to wonder, just like we would wonder, have I gone too far? Have I done too much? Would God still want to use someone like me? Or is my failure final? That's the emotional context for the invitation Jesus made to Peter near Tabgha. So here's how it went down. A few weeks following the resurrection, Jesus' disciple John records that Peter and the other disciples have returned to the Sea of Galilee to do some fishing, sort of return to their roots. And that is significant, because Peter was back at the spot where he had first heard Jesus utter the words, follow me. And he was doing the very same thing he was doing when he first heard Jesus utter the words, follow me. And John tells us that after returning to the Sea of Galilee, the disciples had gone out and been fishing all night and caught absolutely nothing. And then at first light, as the first rays of sun are breaking over the mountains, a man appears on the shore and calls out to them. They're about 100 yards offshore. The water would have carried the voice. And the man says, hey, throw your nets to the other side of the boat, which is kind of ridiculous. Again, I'm not really into fishing, but at least I know that the water on both sides of the boat is part of the same body of water. Are you with me on this, right? So if the fish aren't biting on the left, throwing it to the right is not going to fix your problem, but they do it anyway. And in an instant, they catch so many fish in their net that they can't pull it in. And so in this moment, John recognizes that the man on the shore is Jesus, and he tells Peter. Now check out what happened next. Here's what John writes. He says, as soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, it's Jesus, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he'd taken it off, and he jumped in the water. And I just got to ask you a question. Why in the world is Peter so excited to get to Jesus? I mean, it's been weeks since his failure, and we can't know for sure, but I have a suspicion. I think Peter wanted to talk to Jesus because Peter wanted to apologize, and Peter wanted to explain. You ever been in a situation like that? I mean, you made a poor choice that broke relationship with someone that you love, and you were forced to live with that regret. You'd lay in bed at night thinking about it, replaying the conversation over and over in your mind. You think, I don't know that after what I've done, I'm ever gonna get a chance to talk to them again. But then one day, you run into them in the produce aisle of Aldi. Are you with me? Yeah? I mean, we're all reunions happen in our culture, right? And like they're squeezing the avocados, you're squeezing the avocados, even though it's COVID and we shouldn't squeeze the avocados and we know it, but secretly we still do. Okay, now I'm just ranting, right? Yeah. But you have a chance to say what's on your heart. And so as fast as you can, you get real close to them. And you start to talk because you desperately want to repair some of the damage that was done. You know you can't go back and do things differently, but you think maybe I can say something to sort of soften the wound or maybe even begin to heal the wound. And I think that's why Peter jumped into the water and swam for the shore in a culture where swimming wasn't something they did a ton. Now, as John continues, he gives us the following information. He says, the other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore. He says, and when they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. And Jesus said, come and have breakfast. And I have to be honest, I mean, I spent a lot of time reading the Bible, more than most, some would say more than is healthy, but this is one of my favorite moments in the accounts of Jesus' life. I love that the guys haven't caught any fish all night, and here Jesus is on the shore in the morning grilling fish. Isn't that great? And I also love that Jesus is hungry. He wants to have some breakfast with him post-resurrection. Apparently dying and rising from the grave can give you an appetite, right? And he looks at the guys and he's like, dudes, I have just been to hell and back. I'm telling you, right? Yeah, that was probably over the line. But anyway, we're moving on. So John continues. He says, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, because he knows they have unfinished business as well. He says, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And it's like he's pointing to the fish. And it's interesting that Jesus refers to Peter as Simon because that's the name he had before he followed Jesus. He's like, it's like we rewound the tape. It's like, what about all that stuff that happened? No, Simon, do you love me more than these? It's also interesting to note that in this moment, Jesus asked Peter a question about his future. It's like when he says, you know, do you love me more than these? He's essentially asking, do you want to spend the rest of your life fishing for fish or fishing for people? And Peter couldn't have missed what was going on because Jesus had made the same invitation to him before when he had first left fishing to follow Jesus. And if you spend any time in church, you probably have heard this, the account of that day. A man named Matthew records it for us. Here's what Matthew told us happened 3 years before the conversation that we're studying. He says, as Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew, and they were casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Come follow me, Jesus said, and I will make you, and here it is, fishers of men. Do you want to fish for fish or do you want to fish for people? So that's what Jesus said to them then. But as you know, a lot has happened since then. And by his actions, Peter has severed his ties with Jesus, at least from his perspective. And so Jesus says to Peter, listen, which life do you want moving forward? And I think Peter would have had a lot of questions in that moment, because if Jesus is saying what it seems like Jesus is saying, then maybe there's a chance. Maybe hope isn't gone. Maybe he does get to have a new beginning. And that is what Jesus is saying to Peter. Let's start again. And I love that Jesus, even in this moment, wants Peter to choose. It's like, Peter, I believe that you can do this going forward, but you have to want it. I can't want it more for you than what you want for you. And so, Peter, which life do you want? And just imagine with me what hung in the balance of Peter's decision. It's like the reason we know who Peter is because of what he chooses. in this moment. I mean, think about it. There's a reason there's a St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, right? And the reason it's there is because what Peter chose in this moment. And so without hesitation, Peter responds, "Yes, Lord." He said, "You know that I love you." And Jesus says, "Feed my lambs. Feed my lambs." You're like, "I didn't know Jesus had sheep," right? No. Feeding lambs, that's shepherd's business. So Jesus is basically saying to Peter, "Listen, I want you to dedicate the rest of your life to caring for or shepherding or pastoring people." It's like Jesus has plans for Peter's life that are beyond Peter's wildest dreams, but he needs Peter to choose his path. So he says, "Peter, I see this for you, and I want this for you, and I believe that you can do this, but what do you believe about you? Here's a new beginning, but you need to take the first step." Notice with me that Jesus meets Peter's failure with grace, with undeserved, unmerited favor. It's like, in spite of his denial of Jesus, he asked Peter, "Where do you want to go from here? I know what's in the past, but I have a future for you." Now, amazingly, as this account continues, Jesus asked Peter the same question a second and a third time. John records it this way. He says, "Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" And he answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." Peter's like, I feel like we're in this loop thing. We just did this, but then it gets weirder. He keeps going. The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He says, Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him a third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know I love you." And Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." And honestly, it's a strange passage until you consider the fact that Peter had denied Jesus three times. So it's actually kind of poetic that Jesus makes the invitation to Peter three times. And then though, as Jesus continues, he makes the most incredible invitation that Peter had ever received, seriously. And it's just two words. He looks Peter straight in the eye. He says, "Now you've got it. Now you understand what I'm offering you. Now here's the thing. Here's the invitation. Here's what I want you to do. Follow me. Follow me." The same invitation I made to you 3 years ago is the one I'm making to you now. It's a new beginning. Even after your failure, Peter, I want you to follow me. It's like this scene is completely overflowing with themes of forgiveness and grace. The shocking reality to Peter is that in spite of his mistakes, he has not gone too far. He has not done too much. Jesus still wants a relationship with him, and Jesus still desires to use his life. And he does, in powerful ways. In fact, if you think about it, for Peter, the most significant ministry in his life by far follows this failure and follows the authentic encounter with God's grace. I think Peter understood grace after this conversation in ways that he couldn't have before that. And that's why these moments of failure can be so catalytic to our faith journeys if we allow them to be. Because if we can truly receive God's grace and forgiveness in a moment where we know we deserve it, or we know we don't deserve it, then that really does change everything. And the gospel, the good news of what Jesus came to do, moves from black and white to color. And I've seen it over and over and over and over and over again with people who reach the bottom. And it's in that space that God intersects with their life and communicates something to their heart, to their core, to their soul that they couldn't have gotten any other way. And the good news of this story is that this isn't just about forgiveness and spending eternity with God. This is about forgiveness and grace in the middle of this life. Peter is still used by God after his failure. And you can still be used by God after your failure. In fact, that's what I think we're supposed to take from this reunion. I'm convinced that's right at the heart of what Jesus wants to do for each one of us. And it's amazing news for anyone who's ever felt like God would want nothing to do with them. And so you say, well, okay, what does this look like practically? Like for me, if you came in here today or you tuned in online and you're just sitting in a pool of mess of your own making and you're like, you know, maybe you are at home because you thought, man, if I walk through the church, they might have to repair the roof. You know, I don't know. That, you know, we're coming back to that idea again. But yeah, and it's like, and you're like, I don't know what to do. And so you're tuning in from home, you know, and you kind of got the remote control. If it gets too heavy, you can mute it or whatever. Don't mute it. Stay with me. Okay, right? But to me, practically, it looks like this. We must learn to receive God's forgiveness for our failures. And the same was true for Peter. He had to actually receive it because it does seem too good to be true. It's like, you've got to be kidding me, Jesus. After what I did, you can't want to use me anymore. I mean, I know you said, like, you know, on this rock, I will build my church. And a whole bunch of people think it's literally that's meant Peter. I know you said that, but not after. I mean, come on. I turned my back on you as you were arrested and on your way to being crucified. That's certainly too far, too much. And Jesus would say, no, that's not how this works. You want to move forward with me. Your role is to open your heart up to receive forgiveness from your failures. You go, yeah, mine's too bad. You're not beyond the grace of God. And I think it's critical for us to learn to receive God's forgiveness, because until we do, until we learn to receive that grace, to receive forgiveness, we will always feel like we have disqualified ourselves from our relationship with Him. And our spiritual lives will be consumed with things like guilt and regret and fear and shame. And Jesus came to short circuit all of that and to offer us a new beginning. Because in Jesus, God came down to give us precisely what we didn't deserve. And that means that whoever you are, whatever you've done, you have not disqualified yourself from a relationship with God through Jesus. Because a relationship with God has never been about your worthiness. It has never been about your worthiness. Years ago, a pastor friend said it to me this way, and I'll never forget it. He said, God doesn't love you because you are good. God loves you because He is good. That's the message. That's the message of the gospel. So this stuff's been rattling around in my head all week. And on Tuesday night, I was sitting on my couch with my wife, Sarah Ann, and we were watching some YouTube worship videos because, I don't know, we're weird. And there was a song that came up on the playlist we were watching, and it was so moving. I text Paul, our faithful music guy, and I said, hey, any chance on Sunday we could close with this song? And he right away goes, absolutely. And I love him and his team, and they do amazing things, including my weird last minute changes to the schedule. But anyway, I really want you to experience a song at the end of this teaching. And it's no exaggeration to say this song haunted me this week as I was working on this stuff, because it perfectly encapsulates everything we just explored. The song is called I Am Loved. And it's written from the perspective of the younger brother in Jesus' famous parable of the prodigal son. If you don't know much about the Bible, you've probably heard the story of the prodigal son, right? But just to remind you, like, there's this man who has two sons. And the younger one comes to his father and he says, you know, give me my share of the inheritance now, essentially, Dad, I wish you were dead so I could get my share of the inheritance, and I'm better off without you. And shockingly, in the story, the father's like, here you go. Everyone's watching, and Dad just sort of gives him the inheritance. And so the younger son runs off to a far-off country, Jesus says, and squanders his wealth. And quickly finds himself alone and starving. He's like at the worst spot imaginable for a Jewish kid. He's like sitting in a pig trough. So pigs are unclean animals. Jews don't eat bacon. Many of you know that, right? And he's sitting there and he's longing to eat the pods the pigs are eating. And you're like, does it get any lower? Does it get any worse? And he's like, I've betrayed everybody. I betrayed my family. I betrayed my father. I'm not worthy of anything anymore. And he says to himself, my only option is to return home and to beg my father to hire me as a servant. Be because this is key. What I've done has fundamentally altered who I am. I'm no longer a kid in this family because I betrayed it. I wanted my inheritance. I squandered it. I'm not even worthy to be a slave in this family. And so this younger son makes this long walk home. And it, you know, it may not have been that long physically speaking, but emotionally speaking, it was excruciatingly long. And he makes a long walk home. And as he's approaching the village, Jesus says, his father sees him when he's a long way off. And his father runs at his son. And in the first century, Jewish men didn't run. These are the patriarchs. They're dignified. They're composed. And it's like this dad in the story sees his kid on the horizon, the kid that's lost, the kid that's squandered everything. And tears fill his eyes, and he just starts sprinting for his kid. And his father embraces him. And the kid's crying, and the dad's crying. Everybody's crying, right? I'm crying. I don't know. And the kid's got this speech. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. And the dad, like, doesn't even hear him. The dad calls his servants. He says, get the robe. Get the ring. My kid is back. And this kid's just standing there. He's like, I don't deserve this. There's no way I deserve this. I don't think I could be more unworthy. And yet somehow, and this is the message, somehow this kid is not beyond the grip of grace. And the disciples knew. In this story, Jesus begins, the kingdom of heaven is like. That's like, you want to know what things look like from God's perspective? God is the father in the story, and you're the kid who squandered his inheritance. And you need to know, when you're at your lowest, when you're sitting with the pigs, longing to eat pig food, whatever that is, right? You need to know that you have not gone too far, done too much. You are not beyond the grip of grace. And so in the story, the father welcomes his kid home and accepts him and offers him a new beginning, just as he is. He's loved. Let's listen to this song together, and then I'll come and I'll close our time in prayer. just stand and I'll close us in prayer. Heavenly Father, this morning in this place, we celebrate the fact that you love us, not because we are worthy, not because we are good, but because you are good. And we acknowledge that that grace is right at the center of the gospel. It's right at the center of what you sent your son to communicate to us. And for those of us who've received it, we once again just want to say thank you. I pray that you help us embody that grace to a world so desperately in need. And for friends that are joining us here or that are joining us online that have never understood the message of grace, I pray that this thought would haunt them. That they're not too far gone, that their failure is not final, and that you have a new beginning for them, waiting for them to receive that invitation. And so we thank you. We bless you. We love you because you first loved us. In the matchless name of your Son, our risen Savior, Jesus Christ, we pray. Everyone said, amen. Friends, grace and peace to you. We will see you back here next week.